Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Welcome again to the Awakened Call. Today, in conversation with Christy Nelson, here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Birju Panja, will engage in a deep dialogue with Christy, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite everyone's reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point you can hit star 6 on your phone and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. We have a lot of us on the call today. We'll do our best to get to each person in the queue. So just letting you know that if you get in the queue earlier, we'll be calling on you first. Today's theme, as I've stated earlier, is grateful living as a foundational practice for every moment. First of all, a shout out to the people on our Awaken Call team who scheduled Christy Nelson and this week's theme for Thanksgiving week. Wow, talk about timing. Seems like a lot of people agree, and last time I looked, we've got close to 200 RSVPs for this call, which is the highest that I personally have ever seen. And on a societal level, for a very different reason, the timing of this conversation also feels relevant for many of us in the U.S. and friends around the world at this uncertain and disruptive time following the U.S. election. Helpful guidance here, I think, for all of us. At times of difficulty, uncertainty, illness, or grief, Christy's practice of grateful living encourages us to ask questions like, what is the situation forcing me to notice or allowing me to notice? What is the situation allowing me to learn? What is the situation allowing me to let go of? And what is the situation allowing me to see as an opportunity? So a key question for all of us here today, how have you experienced gratefulness during periods of hardship and loss? We have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Birju, today, who we can start by asking him to kick off the circle. First, a little context. Who is Birju? If you look him up on LinkedIn, you know, where everybody gives fancy titles for their professional titles, Birju's title is human being. He serves as chief mindfulness officer, he calls it chief mindfulness officer. They call it chief abundance officer at Nestle Development with Ari Nestle. And it says there that Birju focuses on the nexus of money, social good, and inner transformation. He's also a managing director with Armonia, a private equity firm specializing in regenerative investing using nature-based solutions. And he's a senior advisor at RSF Social Finance, focusing on projects that facilitate inner impact. And last but not least, Birju has been a long-time volunteer with Service Space, contributing in numerous ways, both visible and not so visible. Birju, thank you so much for joining us. Any opening thoughts for kicking off today's conversation?
Thank you, Arye, for that illustrious introduction. I much appreciate being able to join and I'm very excited to be in conversation today with Christy. I've had a little bit of experience of touching into gratefulness in that period of hardship. I'm very excited to learn from the conversation today, especially because this has been a topic that has been stronger on my mind recently. Earlier this year, my wife went through an emergency surgery that for a little time there was quite uncertain in terms of what the outcome will be. And at that moment, I was just very intrigued at my own inner relationship with what was happening. At some sense, having this feeling that I'm not going to be fighting what is happening. I'm not going to be fighting with other people, not with doctors, not with myself, not with the sense of pain or grief that was coming up, and finding a sense of gratefulness that came up for that, for the not fighting. So maybe the tip of the iceberg in what gratefulness can be over time, but it's part of why I feel so excited to be on this call. And I would love to introduce our guest for today, who to me is been embodying and living these principles of gratefulness for some time now. Christy Nelson is the executive director for a network for grateful living, which is behind the popular website gratefulness.org. She's also spent, to me, a lifetime focusing on social upliftment through both inner and outer work. So this includes senior leadership roles with Soul of Money Institute, Kripalu, which is a retreat center, and the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society. Thank you so much for joining us during Thanksgiving weekend, no less, Christy.
I am so honored and delighted to be here. I am just absolutely thrilled, and thank you so much. I'm humbled, just truly deeply humbled by this whole opportunity, and I want to just be of service because I feel to be in your company, Virju, and REA, and all of these incredible people at Service Space who do your extraordinary work in the world. I just feel really blessed to get to have this time, and I hope to serve. That's my prayer. So I'm just thrilled to be here for this conversation, every little bit of it, and thank you so much for asking me.
Your presence feels like the deepest service, and then everything else is gravy.
That's right. Good. That's a good theme for Thanksgiving. It's all gravy.
Well, how are you today?
I am excellent today. I am. I'm just incredibly happy to be here right now. I took a beautiful walk this morning. I'm. You know, moving through the world, I have dear friends and family with whom to enjoy my life. I feel so blessed for that. So I'm doing really well today. Thank you so much. I'm in relatively good health, which is always true, and it's always an impermanent state. You know, I'm always aware of the fact that being able-bodied and being well is temporary for all of us. So I cherish those moments when I am able to say, I am well, thank you, I'm doing well, thank you very much. So in that spirit, thank you for asking, and I'm doing well. How are you today?
Also doing well. I find myself in tears a little bit more frequently now out of gratitude for the word I use is bittersweetness, that everything is beautiful and it's changing quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily for the worse or better, just it's changing. And
yes, exactly.
There's a beauty there. I appreciate the realness of the response to the question, which is what I was hoping for. And I also wanted to jump in kind of at the top, if you will, that we're here today to talk about gratefulness. So if there was such a thing as a root for that theme, why would you say the topic is so alive for you?
I think it's a great question. I do believe that it's especially alive and acute for me in my life particularly because there was something very profound about facing the absolute reality of impermanence at quite an early age. I mean, I'm not going to call 33 really early. A lot of people suffer very challenging illnesses and near-death experiences at much younger ages than that. But for me, it was kind of in that moment in life when all my friends and peers were making big plans and investing money to be able to buy a house or thinking about having children or getting married. So it was kind of 32 years old was when I was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma. And there's a saying that is quite profound for me, but keep death always before your eyes, is a Benedictine saying that Brother David Stendelrath, who founded our organization, uses sometimes. And what that experience did for me was it put death before my eyes in a way that I would have told you were crazy to ever think that a saying like that would be something that would enrich your life in this really profound way. I had no sense of how that could make sense until I actually faced my own mortality so acutely. And I think that's changed my whole life. I haven't really ever quite said this in this way, but it's been 24 years since then now. And every single moment of those 24 years have been impacted by facing the loss of my life so squarely, so soberly, so directly at that point in my life. And there was some kind of internal pledge, I think, that happened, Birju, in me, which was to never thumb my nose, so to speak, to never take for granted, to never live my life in a way that flew in the face of the gift of continuing to live another day.
I have this interest of wanting to dive deeper into that experience, but also the seeds of that experience. I mean, stage 4 cancer, that is a weighty statement. And I'm curious, even before then, so you mm-hmm. said, early 30s diagnosis, and I look through your history prior to that, and I'm not looking at a person, at least from my understanding, it doesn't scream, philosopher background. You've got, business education, and, schools like Harvard in your background. And I'm guessing that there's, a more communal approach, a conventional background behind there. So I'm curious, were there seeds planted for the depth that, happened after that diagnosis?
Yeah, there have to be, kind of, don't there? I mean, I think in some ways, right? Because quite a garden grew quite quickly there. And so I think I was one of those people at 32, so this was 1992, when people said, if Christy Nelson can get diagnosed with cancer, then it could happen to anyone, because I was one of those people who people saw as extraordinarily healthy. And this was in those days of Bernie Siegel and Louise Hay and a lot of people who had a lot of thinking where it was almost like you could not choose illness. You had a choice around illness or death even. Mm. And so that whole kind of popular movement was really alive when I got sick. The seeds that were in me before that were, I was a vegetarian, I did yoga, I took all the right vitamins, I had been a social activist, a kind of political activist for a long time. My parents were both socially concerned people. I had an early life of having a lot of very strong, passionate social justice values and acted on those really deeply. I had a lot of love and community in my life. So it was kind of like, it really did teach something to me and to everybody around me, which is what do we get to be in charge of and what don't we? And that whole idea that, illnesses, terminal illnesses, there was a kind of flirtation with this idea, this concept at the time, that terminal illnesses only happened to people who didn't want to live.
Mm.
So there was a wrestling in myself and in my community around how that wasn't, just wasn't at all true, and how to live with that and live through that. And but the seeds of love were huge in my life. So the seeds of love for life, the seeds of love for the community and the people, and feeling loved and being actively loved, those were the seeds, I think, and commitment to health that were really strong in me before I got diagnosed.
Hmm. And so you've got these seeds, and yet, you know, that I have a friend who makes this comment that in some ways, you know, what one is learning to do is surfing on life's waves. And mm-hmm. most of the waves of life are 2 and 3 feet. And, you know, they're light enough that you can take them for granted, but what they're doing is preparing you for the 20-foot wave.
That's a very good way to put it.
And so here comes the 20-foot wave. And I'm curious how you evolved in your relationship to cancer through that time.
Well, very significantly, I would say, I had been a very extroverted person who rarely spent time alone. I lived in a communal household. I had close family and friends and community. There's something about being alone, the solitude of a hospital, and the solitude of the number of weeks on end. It's this beautiful work like that the Prison Dharma Project does and all these people do about the prison ashram. The hospital is also the reluctant ashram. It's like where you're, I was confined, and tethered to every kind of IV thing. And because I had fevers of unknown origin for many weeks and months before I was diagnosed, and it was in the early days of HIV, I wasn't allowed to leave the hospital. So I was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and then I was let out, and then I was still really sick, and so I was in again for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I was out, and then I had surgeries, which kept me in for weeks. So I spent most of about a year and a half, almost 2 years of my life, defined absolutely through hospitalization and medical procedures. And that was something that the reluctant experience of that became the giving way to, the riding the wave of, like, wow, okay, what opportunities do I have here when I can't leave my bed and I can't leave this room? And I had run 5 miles the morning before I ended up in the hospital, and I felt totally well. And so learning aloneness, learning this depth of solitude, and a relationship to that solitude that has changed me forever, to deeply, deeply learn something about what I would call prayer, even though I was not raised with religion in any way. I became, I would say, a much more a person grounded in spiritual practice. Meditation became a much more active part of my life. The serenity prayer became a huge part of my life. You know, God grant me the strength to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That felt like it was my medical treatment. It felt like that was the pathway for me to get through everything, and it continues to be in many ways. But I would say kind of that deeper relationship with self, a deeper relationship with not being in the driver's seat, because the transformation, if I were to kind of take it in a crux, like what is the crux of it, and distill it, it would be that I used to be in this way of thinking that I was in control of everything, and that that was the agency of youth and the agency of goal setting and the agency of having dreams and aspirations and affirmations. And so in those early 90s, it was like, if you affirm it, it will happen. If you want it, it's yours. And so what do we and don't we get to be in control of, and how to live like a leaf on the river, how to literally throw my arms up and out as I'm doing right now and close my eyes and say, are there places here that are really calling me to surrender, and that my will and the belief that I'm going to be able to be in control of my experience may actually get in the way of what's meant to happen here. That's the transformation that mostly happened for me. And the relishing of every moment that I got to be alive, thinking that that really might be otherwise.
I'm simultaneously touched by that reflection and want to go deeper. because I feel like without the experience of it and without the rubber hits the road element, that could be received as a platitude, right? Mm-hmm. When I ask myself, why is it that I don't do that, right? Like, I can certainly put my arms out and say, oh, you know, do with me what you will. But the thing that keeps me at deep levels from being able to do that is fear of pain and suffering, and if I went to the root, fear of death. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious. So, you know, stage four is not stage one. And so how does your, what did you do in that relationship to pain, suffering, death in a very real way that allowed for that surrender to blossom in a way that for me, I think is just beyond a glass.
Right. Yeah. You're right. And so I'm goosebumps head to toe with your question, which is always a good sign. You know, without being overly personal, I think the personal is really important, and your whole focus here on story. You have a scale of 1 to 10 where you can place pain, right? And they have those smiley faces on the walls of doctor's offices and stuff where you can kind of say, oh, I'm here or I'm there. I had never known what pain was until I had cancer that metastasized to my spine and my bone. I had no idea in the world that amount of pain was actually humanly possible, or that it was humanly possible to endure and survive. And I spent months in that pain, and it was pain that morphine did not touch. I was on all these different things, and it just wouldn't touch it. And it was like literally every cell in my body to become so attuned to the moment, Birju. There was absolutely nothing else to do but occupy that moment so fully and so surrendered that just to get through, okay, there's the next moment. Okay, there's the next moment. And so it's not abstract at all in my experience. Very difficult to describe, but to experience my thoughts as thoughts and my feelings as feelings and what happened in my body as sensations, all of which were huge but did not by themselves, each one alone or even together, define my whole experience. It was not enough. I learned what was bigger than me in those moments. And that was in that surrender, in that total release, in that abandonment of that idea of control, became the most tremendous empowerment in this way of how to go through and navigate life through things that I never knew before were humanly possible to navigate. The idea of dying, the releasing to that possibility, the amount of pain and all of that. So, you know, I don't say this lightly. It's not something I talk about a lot, and it's very emotional in some ways too, because I'm right back in it. I can feel it in every cell of my body. And it's extremely, it's physical, it's emotional, it's everything. And it's an honor to be able to tell that story and be able to tell it in past tense. Like, it's just unbelievable to me.
I want to thank you for your willingness to go into that place with us. And just want you to know there's a tenderness with which we all receive that story.
Thank you.
And I'd also love to invite the part of your life that came after that, if that feels okay with you.
Sure.
but not so, you know, not like a pivot, but rather the continuation of the same theme. You know, I have heard stories, even in my own family, of people who have had such an experience where the inner evolution is in some ways quickened by such a journey. And yet, you know, there's a period then when the cancer is in remission. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, when we get to that stage, how does that relationship with pain, with death, with surrender, did you find that it stayed? Did you find that you could hold to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so that's great. A great question, because it's not just a really neat formula where, okay, now you're pronounced in remission, and then life goes like, okay, back to where I was before, you know, let's pick up. None of that was possible, right? None of it was possible on any level for me. And I had a friend who had had cancer the same time that I did. She had an early stage cancer, and I said, I'm never going to be the same again. And she said, just you wait, you will.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, I don't want to be the same again. I never want to live as if I do not know what I now know, and as if I didn't go through everything I went through. That was not my longing at all. And yet, it was extremely disorienting, because I remember asking, there were a couple of oncologists who, one said, there is no hope for you. You will not, you know, literally there is no hope for you. You will not be cured. And another one who looked at me, I said, when will I be out of the woods? It's a great question, right? And he said, you'll never be out of the woods. So I have never, listen, literally, I don't know that I've even said this aloud ever in my life, but I decided to live my life in the woods of that knowing, like, right? So I was thinking, you know, can I be out of the woods yet? Am I out of the woods yet? Am I out of the woods yet? And someone says, you're never going to be out of the woods. I was so angry with him at first for that. And then, you know, maybe there's a way to befriend the woods of the human experience, you know. And so, but those first few years, I felt like I was someone who had been diagnosed with HIV, even though I wasn't, because, you know, every sneeze, every ache, every pain, every fever that I got, everything for those first 3 years, it was like, oh, God, is the cancer back again, right? Mm. And here do I, and I was in the hospital every 3 months for full body CAT scans and all that stuff. So there were a couple of years there where I didn't know what to do. I literally did not quite know how to live. And I think that, I hope it's okay to be that honest. It was, And I, if not here, where? And if not with you, with whom, right? but there was that sense of, it was disoriented. I was entirely disoriented, and I needed a period of time to get kind of my body back in the way, to get my thinking back, to figure out, like, would it be responsible to apply for a job? Inside this prognosis, is it responsible to start a relationship? Where do I live? Like, how do I do this? And at the time, Stephen Levine's book was out, you know, if you had a year, pretend you have a year to live. And a lot of people were doing that pretending. And I was like, geez, you know, I wish I could do that and pretend. There was a luxury to that, a kind of indulgence, which I envied, which was, it felt much different to try to go through it when your body, you know, my body was kind of battered and I was trying to kind of get to figure things out. And then I decided after a couple of years of living, literally, it was like 2 years, I think, and I moved to the woods, literally, kind of, and I made it 2 years, and I remember saying, okay, I'm going to live now as if I have another 2 years to go. I'm going to just take this on and experiment with what would I do if I had another year or two to go. And I decided to work for hospice. And that was an incredible experience because I had seen the difference of the people who had gone through cancer with me, who had died with hospice, and the people who did not. And so I thought, well... And that was my first foray kind of back out of the cocoon and the womb of my family and my friends and my community and the natural world being, you know, where I was getting all of my sustenance, to begin to kind of take baby steps back into that world of how do I go forward, assuming that there's a future but not being attached to it. What would that look like?
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for letting me.
I wanna keep on going into this evolution that happened afterwards. That you know, you mentioned, like, oh, should I have a job? And I smiled to myself in realizing the kind of pioneering work for the world that you've done since that thought, should I have a job, came up. And the level of evolution of your inner worldview that must have accompanied that. And so I'm curious. So you know, you do this hospice, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Soul of Money, and then Kripalu. And so what is going on internally? What is your thesis evolving to that leads you to these kinds of ways of working and living?
Well, you know, I started living my life, I think, in these. The first job I applied for after hospice, because I started as a volunteer and then ended up being absorbed and getting paid to do some of the stuff I was doing. And I applied for a job, and it was to be the executive director of the Women's Fund of Western Massachusetts, which was a brand new little organization. And I remember going to the interview, and I was a few years out, maybe 3.5 years out of treatment at that point. And I remember banging my hand down on the table at one point quite passionately. And I said, I believe I was born for this job. And it was like what came out of my mouth and that clarity, it was amazing. And I believe this job was born for me and this match. And it was the place where I grew deeper roots into my life and into the world. And I was there most of 5 years. And it was after that that everything kind of evolved in these kinds of other positions that you talk about. But I remember being really clear, and it was part of the interview. They knew I was a cancer survivor. It came up in the interview and everything, and it was really powerful to be able to say, you know, I'm going to go year by year in my life and you risk nothing, because everybody is going day by day in their life. We're all, there's no promise that anybody's going to make you that you can hang your hat on. Oh, I'm going to be here 10 years. But I can tell you really honestly, I'm going to be here as long as I'm going to be here. I'm going to do it with my full self. And so that's kind of how I've lived a lot of that life. You know, what in your question, I think what came was I had done what I had called social change work before I got ill. And it was more kind of political social change work, working for the Freeze Movement and working for civil rights organizations and environmental organizations. And it was interesting. What evolved for me out of this was what I started to call spiritual social change. That was a big difference and something I never would have seen myself doing before. And I don't even exactly quite know what it means, so I hope you won't test me on it. But it's that place, I think, where the inner transformation and the outer transformation are equally kind of weighted commitments of work in the world. The Center for Mindfulness and Medicine, how do we go about changing the world? It became a different model I was attracted to at that point, and the belief that we could change systems through changing consciousness. And yeah.
So I deeply resonate with what you just said. And I'm curious about it, because when you combine that perspective of what you are doing with the kinds of jobs that you're talking about that sound really sexy from the outside, and then there's a component that is less sexy. You know, it's the day to day. It's the thing that looks a lot like corporate America. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious. So as you're continuing to come off of this experience, now you're hit with the day to day of whether it's fundraising or getting your name out there. How do you reconcile that? Where is the sacred in that mundaneness?
Oh, everywhere. Everywhere. It's not there where. That makes me cry. So the gift of being able to show up for all of those small moments and small things and small gestures which add up to something significant, the gift of being inside those moment-to-moment tasks of work, you know, the responsibilities of work, the pressures of work, and to hold them as sacred is, to me, a huge chunk of the work of my life. To remember the privilege. It could be otherwise. Here I am, you know, signing things and pushing papers around and building stuff on our website and doing things that feel, in how you would look at them maybe from the outside, they feel like how could one find this to be the most beneficent kind of thing to be doing with a life that maybe wasn't supposed to be, you know, those tasks. But it's the same as the tasks of loving. It's the actions of loving life, loving other people, loving what we get to love, the privilege of that. It could look on the outside, if you were to put a little camera, you know, on what I do to love the people I love in my life, it would look pretty unsexy a lot of the time. It looks like a lot of dishes and a lot of cutting vegetables and a lot of, you know, the stuff of raising a family and loving the people I love, you know, getting in my car and driving soup across to my sister, you know, day before yesterday because she was so sick. And it's in each of those tasks of making things happen and just rising to the occasion of the yes of all of it, that is what makes it sacred, knowing that it's all those little teeny things like planting a garden. My God, how hard they work, the farmers around here, to make this extraordinary harvest come to us in the late summer and early fall. And the work of it and the day-to-day of it, I think there's a poem that I think of a lot. Just going to see if I can find a line or two from it because it moves me. It's really meaningful to me. And I'm just grabbing this book. And it's called Otherwise, and it's by someone named Jane Kenyon. And she died not long after she wrote this poem of cancer. And she said, just a couple of lines, I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet, milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood. All morning I did the work I love. But one day I know it will be otherwise.
Yes.
So I think keep death always before your eyes. Keep impermanence always before your eyes makes everything sacred.
Mm.
Because it always could be otherwise.
Hmm.
Does that answer what you were asking?
Yeah, I was just needing two more deep breaths on that one.
Take the time, please.
Christine Birju,
I'd
just like to come in for a brief moment here to remind everyone listening to queue up any questions you have. If you're on the phone and you would like to ask Christy a question, dial *6. Or otherwise, if you're live streaming or if you'd prefer to submit it in writing, it's ask@servicespace.org. And after 10 o'clock, we'll be taking your questions.
Thank you, Arye.
Yeah, at 10 o'clock Pacific, top of the hour for most folks.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, right, after top of the hour. Thank you, Birju.
Of course. So Christy, you mentioned Brother David a bit earlier in this conversation. I'm curious if you could share a little bit more about what your work today feels like.
You know, I was thinking earlier, this job, and this job, it just feels like so funny to say that, to have the privilege to be the executive director of a network for grateful living, is truly extraordinary. And I wanted to just to say, it's one of those things that in the interview that I had, you know, there might have been, I don't know, 8 people on the line interviewing me. And Brother David wasn't on the line yet. I did an interview with him after that. But one of the questions was, tell us about a time when you've been through the fire of life. They didn't know anything about me at this point. I just sent in a cover letter and resume. Tell us about a time that you've been through the fire of life and what you learned and what it taught you about being grateful. So that's quite a job interview, you know. I mean, when I put myself in there, I said, you know, this is, now I'm home. When our experiences of going through difficult times can be considered an asset that we can bring to our work. I met Brother David when I was working with Lynn Twist about 13 years ago, and I fell in love with him immediately, as most people do. He is an extraordinary being of light. He is a phenomenal teacher. At the time, he was just beginning to start a network for grateful living. And we had great conversations. He and Lynn were conspiring about how to raise the money to make this whole thing happen. And I was at the time working for Lynn, with Lynn. So no idea that 10 years later I would have this job. But Brother David is, as most people know, he's over 90 years old now. His energy, his joyfulness, his sense of humor, his generosity of spirit, are grateful living embodied. And there are not many people we get to meet in our lives who are big teachers, who take up a big space in the social transformation, inspiration realm in the way that some of these teachers do, who really walk what they talk and who really live what they speak. And Brother David Stengel-Rast is one of those. And this, the gift that he has given to the world of this organization through the portal of gratefulness.org and through this organization and what we do, is astounding what a difference it makes to people. And, you know, he lives in Austria now. He's there most of the time. He does travel extensively. For somebody who's over 90, it puts all of us to shame. You know, when I'm loath to pack my bag and get on a plane, I just think, oh my God, Brother David does this all the time. He's amazing. But he is a true teacher, and he is one of those people who I think makes religion and spirituality a really embracing, safe, intriguing terrain for a lot of people to occupy who have either left the church or who have never defined themselves that way, because he occupies that place that he will say gratefulness, and that's really where he lives, is at the heart of all prayer and all spirituality and all religion, is that sense of that foundational, that great, being grateful is that foundational practice of every day, getting up and seeing what the gifts are of the day, that life itself is a gift. He makes that place safe for a lot and appealing for a lot of people to hang out and to practice and to come to greater life, to find comfort and inspiration. And so we serve a lot of people who are trying to find a different way, a different path, where all these different practices, whether it's Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, agnosticism, you know, Hinduism, all these things come together and find a common terrain. And Brother David has done that interfaith work for so many years. He was so ahead of his time in terms of practicing with Zen Buddhists and Jewish leaders. And so he's an extraordinary man.
So thank you for sharing that as context. And I'd love to bring more of my cognitive mind online, if you will.
Sure.
In the sense that you mentioned earlier that, you know, your work is connecting this inner side to things like systems. And, you know, here you are working on gratefulness, so to speak. And I'm curious why you would say that this sort of stuff, this work, matters in a world that is perceived to have these major crises, whether you look from your lens and you see an economic crisis or ecological, and of course we can go on. How does this kind of work fit into that?
Seems really counterintuitive, doesn't it, in a way, which is what often it makes it so much more powerful. It's like when we let go of things, we actually can occupy them more fully. So gratefulness, we believe that to come from a place of gratitude for what is available to be grateful for, and there's obviously clear understandings, we can't be grateful for everything. We're not meant to be grateful for everything. But to come from that place of gratitude for what we are capable of being grateful for in the moment is really a powerful way to approach what it is that needs to be impacted in our lives. When we're grateful for something and we love that thing, but so it's like if you feel gratefulness for the earth or you feel gratefulness for other people or for your diverse neighborhood, and you really live inside that diversity, that love for that diversity, you are much more likely to want to protect it, to do what it's called, you are called to do, to uphold it, to preserve it in the world, to take a stand on behalf of something. And I think we're afraid that gratitude is like a platitude or something. Gratitude is like if we get grateful, we're going to get complacent.
Mm.
And it's actually the opposite. When we're grateful for things, we're much more likely, I think, to have an energy that is active on behalf of the things that we love and treasure. And we're afraid, I think, because we're a culture, and I know it from myself, from personal experience, that if we're afraid and we anticipate things not being there and we live inside scarcity and there's not enough and what if there isn't enough and what might happen and, you know, we're projecting the future, you know, we're doing all these things, we're so, I think, loath to occupy that gratitude for that fear of complacency and everything. But we think that that other energy of complaint and of scarcity and of anger and fear, that it's a higher level motivator sometimes for making the world reflect our longings than gratitude. And that's a really powerful invitation for us to consider.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Does that make sense?
Oh, I've been reflecting on this recently, how I've used anger, a sense of unworthiness, etc., as fuel for doing my work in the world for so long without knowing it.
Mm. Great, great insight. And for me, fear has been a huge motivator, you know, to get me kind of out of the house and, you know, literally, you know, what will happen if I don't do it versus is there a way to come from the celebration of what is sacred to us that makes us, that brings our more full selves to those difficult things in life that we have to deal with outside of ourselves, to systems, to relationships. And there's core values and principles around gratefulness and grateful living, which we believe really point us toward much more curious relationships with one another, much more inquisitive relationships with one another, much more engaged, generous, respectful relationships with one another. And in that sense, if we can be grateful, then from ourselves, just taking ourselves and then into kind of going into larger concentric circles of how do we show up with that gratefulness for communities and for what is possible and what's the opportunity that we can be grateful for in that moment to make a difference to this universe to which we belong, and how can we treat one another gratefully in a way that inspires us to really stand up and know what is unjust from that place of gratitude for what is just, from the place of gratitude for what is sacred. And then when it is called out, it's not that we have to be anticipating all the time that it's going to go away, but when it is, that we trust ourselves to know it in that moment and know what we're called to do. That we don't have to live ungratefully and live fearfully and live out of anger and live out of scarcity as if that's going to protect us so that we'll know the second, oh, yeah, I've been anticipating this. Now I'm ready. Maybe gratitude and gratefulness actually is the readying terrain for really standing up in our most powerful ways to what we need to do and what we're called to do in our lives to live our values, to move forward the things that we care most deeply about when things are difficult and not as we need them to be.
Well, so this leads me to thinking about where you're going. I'm curious where your edge with this inner work is right now, holding the idea that gratefulness, you know, it may not be the silver bullet, so to speak, but part of a broader root system. And where is gratefulness leading you to?
Take a deep breath right this minute and consider your question. I would say that for me personally and kind of where we are organizationally, it's about right now I'm on an edge of having faith that I will be called to do something or to do many things that are outside of my comfort zone in certain ways, to take a stand for things that I feel really passionate about, and to practice not jumping the gun and jumping into actions or doing things or joining things because I feel like I should, but to really trust that if I feel into where those callings are going to come in my own life, from that place of great fullness, being full and being full of gratitude for the opportunities, that I will know what those things are, that I don't have to go right now spending all of my energy kind of seeking and scrounging for those in some way. I don't know if that sounds, if you get what I'm saying. I don't have to work that hard. I know when something comes as a calling to me and my heart is open and I am available, I will do whatever is called to do. And to cultivate the stand, the kind of Aikido, the posture, the yoga posture, the way of being in the world, arms wide open, heart wide open, grateful for every moment and everything that is available and all of the freedoms that we have, that's when I'm going to know what it is that makes sense for me to do next in any way in my life. I pray that would be so. Yeah, thank you. That's a real humility. That's a humble prayer.
I'm going to turn it over to Arye for this next segment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you, Birju. What a deep dialogue. I want to invite everyone on the call to join us if you like. If you're on the phone, just hit *6 and you'll be in the queue. If you're live streaming or want to submit your question via email, it's ask@servicespace.org. I have a question I'd like to ask, Christy. You know, you've been talking about inner transformation, outer transformation, the relationship between the inner work and the social action. So my question is, what if you're, I can speak from my experience that these days I've been finding myself having conversations with various people about social action and what can we do to protect people who are vulnerable, et cetera, and these kinds of things. And in these kinds of dialogues, I'm hearing a lot of energy around social justice. We have to fight. We have to resist. We have to do what is right. And there's, you know, this kind of fighting energy in these conversations. So my question is, how does one, you know, what can I or what can any of us do when we find ourselves in that situation to shift the energy toward gratefulness? If I say to somebody, well, why not be grateful for what we have? You know, a lot of times it doesn't work. What's your experience of how we can do that?
Well, there's the hard question right up front in the half hour.
Okay, we thought we'd start, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. You know, clearly, grateful living is an active, engaged way of being in the world. So it's really important that we don't mistake why don't we just be grateful for what we have as a passivity or as a complacency or as a kind of collusion. That could be a really easy collusion in the powers that be, that nobody ever do anything and we all just sit around and be grateful for what is going well. Meanwhile, you know, there's large forces at work that are directing our world right now in ways that those of us who have what I would call grateful living's values, core values of respect and compassion and, you know, grateful living actually requires taking a stand, because it's the living part. And Brother David says, we need to stop, we need to look, and we need to go. It's not just stopping. So there's a lot of people who could embrace gratitude and say, oh, I'm just going to stop and sit around and notice what I'm grateful for and, you know, count all my pretty things and, oh, yeah, take an inventory of all my stuff. No, that's not it. And all my blessings, all my privileges. It's really to say, look around and notice what it is that you're grateful for, and can we act from, what would it look like to act on behalf of what's right from that place of what are you grateful for that you want to protect? What, you know, right now, Standing Rock, let's look at what are the things that people are taking a stand for,
mm-hmm.
that come from a place of absolutely clear, righteous, we will not lose the thing that is the resources that we cherish, long for, love the most, that are our treasured things. And that has a go element to it. It has a huge action to it. And for all of us, that action is going to look different. But it's not when you're grateful that you sit around and do nothing about it.
Yeah.
It is about seizing an opportunity available to you to act boldly, actually, on behalf of those things that you are grateful for, and that they not be lost for anyone. This is really important as a distinction. I think gratitude doesn't have this distinction, but gratefulness does, and grateful living does, and those are really important distinctions.
Have you found a way, if you find yourself in the midst of a conversation, to something to say to change the conversation?
I think, you know, I worry about trying too much to change the conversations. You know, I think that because what you can do is embody a different conversation sometimes more easily than you can change the conversation. And so what I would say is there's something about modeling and embodying.
Uh-huh.
What does it look like? And to experiment with it. We're all experimenting with this right now. What does it look like to emanate from that place in yourself? That is, you know, and there are Lynn Twist will, you know, a lot of people will differentiate between taking a stand and having a position. If you take a stand, it's this really proactive, positive, moving towards something. I'm taking a stand for something. And having a position is, you know, you're much more digging your feet in and there's something there. So I think there's a way that there are fine distinctions here, but I would encourage that right now we're all struggling so heartily and mightily in what's changing in our world right now to figure out how to move forward. And the truth is what we have to do is act, and what we have to do is act from the place that is ours to act from, but not acting is not making a difference. So
got it.
Fine, right.
Yeah, for me, the key word is modeling. That makes sense.
Okay.
Thank you. Here's a question submitted online from Mish in New York. And she says, feeling so blessed by Christy's call, facing my third surgery in the past 5 mm-hmm. years soon, so today's call is timely and Christy's words so deeply resonate, feeling blessed by the timing. Each surgery has grown my heart, enabled deeper gratitude for life, and increased my compassion and empathy for others. I'm riding the waves and still standing. Grateful for being enabled in large part by belonging to the Service Space and Kindspring family to have found my inner strength to handle the 20-foot waves, and knowing the blessings are always part of our lives of trial. In deep gratitude, Mish. Okay, so that was her comment, Christy.
Thank you. It makes me really cry, Mish. Thank you.
And we have our first caller.
Hi, this is Wendy from Half Moon Bay. Am I on?
You are on.
Oh, okay, thank you. It was a little difficult to come up with a question because I'm feeling so overwhelmed and touched by so many aspects of this conversation that that really resonate with me. And so I'm very grateful so much for the conversation and Birju's moderating and of course, Ari's hosting. So my question, it's also kind of a practical question and along the social action question. You know, these times, these very difficult times do call for action, but those of us who are dealing with illness and may not have a lot of energy or in pain, how do you suggest responding to this call when we have limitations? And, you know, I certainly feel guilty. I would like to do more, but I do have certain limitations. So how are we able to be part of making this a better world, yet we may not be able to be as physically active as others?
Thank you, Wendy. And I think, you know, what came up for me when you were asking your question right away is that it's interesting because everybody I know has limitations, right? And I have limitations and you have limitations. We all have different limitations. But everyone is wrestling with limitations in different ways. And sometimes those limitations are about what we see and don't see. They take very different forms. But we're also limited. So that's the first thing, is we're all in the cauldron of limitation. I just want to say that. And secondly, I think I know some people who have found tremendous value in participating in group calls that are focused on very deep meditation and very deep kind of subtle activism. There's something called subtle activism. So it's, There's different ways to be an activist, and there's letters you can write, and there's money you can send, and there's things you can do that support movements that you want to join or issues you want to address. But I think it would be interesting to even tune into what are the different ways, you know, that a group of people, instead of all doing the same thing, what would it look like to create a holistic group of people who are each taking a different path and a different piece in a different way and really affirming that and knowing that in the aggregate, we are all contributing as long as we're contributing what we're called to contribute with our limitations. There's something for me that is extremely heart reassuring for me, that when I can only do the one thing I can do that day, knowing that I'm connected in some very deep way, you know, through service-based or other ways, but expressing that, creating a group where you're sharing with each other what you did and knowing that other people's things that they may have done with less limitation or different limitations just complement yours. So it's never one action on its own. It's really in an engaged community. And what a beautiful way to create community is to say we each bring our own different action forward and we all together, what is that beautiful, it's like our purpose is where our greatest gifts meet the world's greatest needs. And that doesn't look the same on any single human being in that moment all the time. It has subtleties to it, but that if we can listen to that calling of what your purpose is, you know, what our purpose is right now in that moment. I love that idea of being one small piece of a very big whole, but being a very fine and integral piece of that whole.
Thank you so much, and a lot to ponder and to sit with and also to act with. Thank you.
Thanks, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy. Birju, I'm wondering if you have any further thoughts or questions at this point.
Yes, thank you, Arye. Christy, I'd be curious for your reflection on the, I'll call it the shadow side of these sort of practices. For instance, I have seen, at least from my eyes, a few examples of what I would deem as gratefulness or mindfulness being used as a sort of a tranquilizer to accept the status quo in modern social systems. You know, we should be happy with what we have, if you will, or if you're finding yourself unhappy in the workplace, you know, mindfulness will calm you down. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious on your reflections on dissolving that potential edge.
I remember having been involved in mindfulness movement for a while, and yoga, kind of, you know, and the yoga being similar, it's like there's a self-indulgence that could be seen to it, where a myopia and it kind of justifies, as you say, that tranquilizing. I think there's an edge to everything, and I think it's one of the reasons why I do think that there's this really important part about waking up, that these mindfulness wakes us up. Gratefulness can wake us up. It keeps us awake, wakes us up to opportunities and to all of those possibilities to learn and to act. Yoga can wake us up. Meditation can wake us up and keep us alive. And then what we do once we're awake, it's really interesting because there's often not very much prescription for that. You just keep waking up, you know, just stay on a cushion, or you just keep meditating. But I know that there is an action component that people are increasingly looking toward. What is engaged mindfulness? Mindfulness kind of began in this way where it really was just on the cushion. Yoga was on the mat. You know, gratefulness was, you know, kind of gratitude was in your journal. And there's a way that they're really coming out now. And I think we hold social movements and we hold transformational ways of being to account when we ourselves practice them and practice right up against those edges. It's easy for almost anything to be tranquilizing. Love can be tranquilizing. Love can be activating. So I think there's something very important for me that in this movement about grateful living, that there really is a go component, there really is an action component to it that I think is the critical edge that gets people off the cushion of their own tranquility and has us embrace gratefully those things that are difficult and challenging, knowing that those are the edges that we have to occupy and that, you know, there are things that happen in the world that absolutely require us to take a stand. And I believe grateful living points our way there.
I've got a question, Christy. My question is, for those of us who might have, say, friends or family members who are going through difficult illnesses. And the question is there anything that we can do to encourage them, support them in shifting from complaining and feeling bad to gratefulness? Mm-hmm. I know you spoke to my earlier question about modeling it. You know, how might that work? Say if I'm talking to a friend and they're having a really hard time, how can I be helpful to them in shifting to gratefulness?
Well, the first thing is to let them complain as much as they need to.
Okay.
that's my first thought, is to really deeply listen and be present for all of what is terrifying. And I think that's one of the things, the worst thing in the world is that, like, that we want to rush people through their suffering and we want to rush people through grief. You know, it's like, aren't you kind of done yet? And haven't you seen the light yet? And, you know, when we've lost someone and illness, it's like, you know, as I said, it took me years of disorientation before reorienting, and I think I'm constantly disoriented in certain ways by keeping an awareness of death and keeping my memory of illness so fresh in my life. And that disorientation is energizing for me, right? So I don't think we want to do away with that which is difficult in our, that we're struggling with. But I would say, again, modeling how you could actually sit gratefully with someone who is just absolutely terrified and absolutely in pain or hurting and, you know, angry, whatever, about what's happening. And just to be present with that person is an embodiment of something that will be one of the greatest gifts you'll ever give in your whole life. And people find their way, and people sometimes, they have a very different life path than you might have in mind for them. And there's always a question that I think is helpful, which is, what is the opportunity here? Is there an opportunity here for you, and not feeding that, but for me, the question was always relevant, is what is, as you started the opening with, what is the opportunity to love? What is the opportunity to learn? What is it, what's the opportunity to act, to be grateful? So I think being able to identify opportunities in the midst of pain and suffering and illness and loss and grief or depression and fury and everything that feels so like it just constricts our entire universe down to that sensation, that sense of being right in that moment, that if we can expand it by considering what the opportunities are, that's a gift in and of itself. So can we identify opportunities that just kind of gives a little more breadth to the space we can occupy when we're hurting? And I think that's maybe the thing that I would say.
Beautiful. Thank you, Chris. Okay, we have our next caller in the queue.
Hi, Christina. My name is Pavi. I'm calling from Belmont, California, and it's just been beautiful to hear.
Hi, Pavi.
Hi, Arye. Hi, Birju. I had a question about just, like, for you personally. This is a question we asked at our family Thanksgiving dinner. We went around, I think the youngest person was 9 and the oldest was in her 80s, and just asked, when you look back on this last year, for you, like, is there a particular moment or story that comes up that shines with that quality of gratefulness?
Well, what comes immediately to mind is, very personal, is I was married. I got married last month.
Wow.
And it's tremendous. It was tremendous to marry someone. and it brings me, just to think of it, you know, we've been together over 13 years, and it was the most tremendous affirmation of love and the possibility and the expansiveness of the heart and our commitments and joy. It was a celebration of joy, and there was not a dry eye in the place. There was so much crying and so much laughter, and to have arrived at a moment to have found a person in my life to marry, to commit to in this really deep journey of love that we're on, that is amazing to me. And a gift that is, it keeps on giving every single day. So, and I look back on that moment, you know, now I think it's really important. That moment emboldens me in the face of all that has happened in this past month. It gives me great courage, and it makes me want to live my life more boldly on behalf of love. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of those places that being grateful makes me want to be active on behalf of other people, and to stand up for other people, and to because I married a woman.
Mm.
And that's an extraordinary thing and an extraordinary gift to be able to do, and to do that in my lifetime. And I never thought I would marry a woman. This was not in my plan to marry a woman. So, you know, one of the things about gratefulness is to be surprised. And I was really surprised that this happened in my life, in my adult years. It was never part of my earlier life. And so this privilege and this thing for which I can be grateful, so when we ask ourselves those questions, it makes me really want to be clear that that's just not an individual privilege that I'm happy to just enjoy for myself. When I'm grateful for something, I want to protect it. And so that leaves me really clear about how important it is that love is love, and I will be a stand for love in my life big time because of that. So thank you.
Wow. What a beautiful way to end the call. Congratulations, Christine.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, you know, we traditionally, for the last question, I'm going to ask you the traditional awakened call last question, which is, how can we as a service-based community support your work?
Oh, that just moves me so deeply. Isn't that the most beautiful question to be asked? Wow, so moving. Thank you. Be a part of our community as well, and let's keep figuring out ways to collaborate. Gratefulness.org is an extraordinary gift for the world, and there's nothing I would rather have than to share that with all of you, any of you, each of you. Heart to heart, join us on gratefulness.org. It's a wonderful space to hang out, and we already are collaborating a lot with Service Space. We intend to continue to do that even more, and we're really deeply aligned, and I would just be honored to share our gifts with all of you in any way we can, as you do with us so freely in the world. So a deep bow of gratitude to you for that question. Please come see us at www.gratefulness.org, and stay in touch with me. I'm reachable there. You can find me. So thank you so much for your time and attention and big heart today. I'm very humbled to have been part of your day.
That's beautiful, and we'll make sure that we have a gratefulness.org in our thank you note to all of the people who attended the call. And
thank you, Ari.
Christy, just thank you again. You've touched my heart. I think you've touched all of our hearts with your story and your wisdom and that vision that you have of more, you know, more connection, greater bandwidth of connection among our communities. You've moved that forward today. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And Birju, thank you too.
Thank you.
What we'll do at this point is we will end the call with a collective minute of silence and gratitude. And after the silence, we'll open up all the lines. I should say gratefulness rather than gratitude. Gratitude and gratefulness.
Yeah.
And after the silence, we'll open up the lines for all of us to say thank you to Christy.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.